Hello. Today we're talking about Who Is Your Team as part of our ongoing Teams podcast series. I'm Al Ritchie from Lateral Coaching.
And I'm Ian Farrington from ProDev UK Limited.
So starting to think about this topic, who is your team? I guess the first place we start is literally who is your team. So that could be the people sitting around the table, or it could be a lot more than that, Ian, couldn't it?
Yes, I think it's that natural human instinct that when we say who is in the team, our heads go straight to Fred, Ginger, Bob and Alice. Actually, that question opens up quite quickly once you start to think about it, because it's not just about people. It's about their personality. It's about their capability. It's about the role that they be playing in whatever the team is there to do.
There's also something around capacity in this. And by that, I mean the capacity of somebody in terms of the time they have available. It's not to do with their capability. It's where they can give time to the team to take the actions that they need to take.
I'd absolutely agree with that. And I think what already we're starting to point at is that question of who is in your team is inevitably linked to what is the team about. And understanding what the team is there to do, and understanding how we draw that boundary between we, the team, and everybody else, whether that's internal or external stakeholders.
Okay. The first thing you said in there was what the team's about, effectively. So let's move on to that for a minute. How do we define what the team's about?
So I think there's a bit of understanding for ourselves that I suppose we might talk about hard and soft teams, because in the way that most of us operate, we tend to operate with an idea of soft teams. We like to communicate. We like to engage. We like to have people feel included.
Yeah, I get that.
So everybody becomes part of our team. And so you have that sense. Go to a standard football match and it doesn't matter whether you're playing in the park or playing in a huge 100,000 people stadium. There is that sense that the fans are the part of the team.
That's true. And actually, you often read them saying we as the team, even though they're not literally on the team, they're in the stadium.
Exactly. And there is that sense of that's how we like to engage, and we do the same in business as well. That's handy until you start working out who's actually responsible for doing what and who needs to get on and do things. And then suddenly that inclusive, quite fuzzy boundary actually becomes unhelpful. So we get pushed into thinking more about what we might call a hard team. And for a hard team to be effective, what we're talking about at that point is actually having a unique focal point and purpose.
Yeah.
Some real clarity about it.
Sorry, I interrupted. My apologies. In other words, what are we here to do?
Exactly. You've then got an idea of how do we know the team's going to be effective? An idea of, well, what type of team do we need? Is it there to work with others? Is it there to be a bridgehead? Is it there to go off at a dark corner and think radical things?
Okay, well, that's part of the purpose as well, is it not?
It is, but that also means that you maybe want people with slightly different characters, slightly different mindsets.
Yeah, okay. So deciding who you need to have then depends on the purpose of the team in this particular iteration of the team, because that's another thing too. The team tends to evolve over time.
Absolutely.
So at day one, you need Fred and Ginger. Oh, I can't remember. There was Alice, and who was the other one?
Bob and Alice.
Bob and Alice. Thank you for reminding me. And at some point later, you need to add Bob and Alice, and maybe you get rid of Fred. Maybe Fred leaves the team because his work is done. So this is so the membership of the team is a dynamic, or there is a dynamic to the membership of the team.
And I think if we are focusing on that hard team, that group of people with a distinct focal point and set of responsibilities, typically you're looking for that team to be six or fewer people. Because once teams begin to get larger than that, it starts becoming its own beast and starts consuming its own management time, often in a disproportionate way, as opposed to doing the thing that the team is supposed to be there to do.
I get that. I do remember reading that you need to keep the membership to less than two digits, which would suggest a number limited to nine. And that was based on the number of connections And that if you've got nine people, then everybody is connected to eight other people. And that gets very complex to manage. But that's a different situation to the one you're describing, where the team is taking on a life of its own. Yeah.
I think so. And you might start to think, well, what happens if we're managing some huge project or program? And then it's really about how you manage clusters of authority in that space. But in each space, at each level, keeping that core group, that core team fairly small is always going to be an advantage. It's easier to communicate with each other. It's easier to work out what we're doing together. It's easier to establish a culture of collective action and collaborative practice and collective responsibility, all of which really matter if the team's going to be effective. It also makes communications outside the team easier, because there's only ever a small number of you that need to sort of collude with each other to make sense of what to say and when to say it and how.
I was actually going to bring up the point about collaborative working, because it's all about collaboration between the key members of the team. But you've covered that one off for me, so thank you very much on that basis. But also, this all relates then down to effectiveness as well of the team.
Yes.
The hard team. And if the team is not effective in what it's trying to do, then it's not fulfilling its purpose in any way at all. The other thing that comes out of this little bit was you mentioned team type, and so it could be a research team, a blue sky thinking team, it could be a production team, it could be a sales team. The list is probably endless.
Yeah.
Does that make any difference to what makes the team, in your view?
So I think it does, because I think it's a very different mindset to be involved in, let's say, forensic research, or to be involved in conceiving of the next game that's going to hit the PC and PS markets. They're different spaces, they're different groups, they're different ways of connecting. I suspect there are also different ways of engaging external stakeholders. And we can come back to the stakeholder part of that, but that does suggest internally you are looking for a different mix in terms of balance of innovation, conscientiousness, ability to throw ideas around, to work with others, to pick up an idea and run to test an idea, ability to package those things up.
I think one of the differences between the two team types you outlined there is also to do with the longevity of the team. If they're doing forensic research, that team could be around for a decade. Maybe that's overkill, but an awful long time. If somebody's coming up with ideas for a new game, then it's all about time to market. So I guess that has an impact on the personalities and the roles that the team members have to play.
Absolutely. And also that starts to point to, rather like a jigsaw piece, teams tend to exist within a larger organization.
Mm.
So there is a consequence here that function changes form, changes role. That means the team piece of the jigsaw is going to look different, yeah, and therefore is going to connect in different ways across the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. So the more you look at this, the more involved and complex it becomes. So you end up with a multidimensional model in your brain, which is not necessarily the easiest thing to work out.
Well, you're then faced with that problem of, so how do I put a team together? Because you can look, once you start to unpick the complexities of a team, you can look at the whole list of roles and requirements, and you can decide, actually, your team needs to be about 1,500 people strong to do everything. Now, we know that's not going to work, and there's some sympathy. In the real world, what happens much more often is we need to establish a new team that has to kick off on Monday. We should have a research person, we should have a marketing person, we're going to need some strong comms, and we're going to need people who can manage a number of applications to support what we're doing. What we've got is Fred, Ginger, Bob, and Alice. And they may not be the people with the right skills or the right mindset. And a lot of organizations find there is that natural tension, often without necessarily being clear about what the tension is. We don't quite know, why isn't it Fred? Because Fred's done all kinds of delivery. Well, maybe. But actually, if Fred is not of a forensic mindset, maybe he's not going to deliver a forensic team solution. So yeah, it takes us into that world of understanding interpersonal and team dynamics as part of that question, who is the team? Not just about their role, but their personality within them, yes, but also in terms of how they approach work and how they approach colleagues and tasks.
And that very neatly brings us on to some of the stuff around profiling, okay? Because at least there's an opportunity to help identify some of these things through various profiling techniques.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% certain that they're as effective as they claim to be, and there seems to be a lot of stats involved in some of the answers that come out of it. But the two main ones, I guess, for teams are Profit and Belbin.
I would say so. At the moment, there are a couple of others knocking around. There are quite a few of the personal assessments that will offer some insight. And I think for me, the important thing is recognizing there is no silver bullet here. And often when I'm, particularly when I'm working in a coaching space or in team development space, I am less worried about the particulars of do you fit profile A or profile B than actually what I find to be the real value in these spaces, which is giving clients a language to talk about these issues in a neutral and constructive way. So this stops being about, I can't work with Fred because he's always doing this, and why does Ginger always need this? And becomes much more about, so we have people here who are very good at looking at the detail, and one person in the team is very good at looking at the big picture. They're different languages. How do we help you communicate with each other better?
That's very true, isn't it?
I think if we approach the assessments in that way, they can become very powerful tools.
Okay, that's fine. Fair enough. I remember that doing Belbin back in, oh, it must have been 1990, something like that. And even the names of some of the roles weren't quite the same back then. I was on a project management course. The other people on the course had to have some sort of leadership skill for the most part, because you can't lead a project unless you've got some idea about leading people. Out of the eight of us, three of us were shapers. And it was so obvious. By the way, that includes me. It was so obvious from the way things were going within that, and within the course, that there were three people who were actually driving and not necessarily taking much account of what everybody else wanted.
That's not an uncommon picture in a team.
Yeah, well, that's true as well. But I think that the point I'm trying to get to here, actually, is that we kept on coming back to Belbin and what we'd learned from it. And that was a real eye-opener for most of us. Yeah, I get the point you make that they can be really beneficial.
Well, if I think about a recent example, taking the Profit tool, I suppose one of the main differences is Belbin feels a little bit more focused on behavioural traits.
Yeah.
Whereas Profit is a little bit more focused on a notion that there are some core roles that have to be performed within a team. And it's more about how we align, how we respond to each of those roles. And I was involved in an exercise recently, just a very simple low-key conversation around how a team might come together and looking where our strengths were, where there were some weak areas. And what stood out was we didn't have much by the way of enthusiasm in the space of coordinating and getting things done.
That's a bit of a snag if you're a team.
Well, but interestingly, what it produced was a conversation in the team that said, okay, so we need to grip this. And so we had team members step forward and go, right, fine, I'm going to take control of the diary. And they have done.
So what you're seeing out of that is that because of the realization of a hole, the action is being taken to plug that hole.
Yes. And for me, importantly, this was the assessment tools providing a neutral but constructive language to have that conversation in. Because too often without that mediation, what happens is we know that we're not progressing and fear and panic kick in. And then it becomes about a blame game and passing the buck and all that. And then, of course, that just means things get progressively worse at a faster rate. Having that medium by which to come back together and say, OK, there's an issue that seems to be in this space. Why is it happening? Without it being anyone's fault as such, but recognizing that the balance of talents needed to be shifted slightly.
The other thought that comes to my mind here is that with Belbin, people who are defined as completer finishers are often also called nitpickers by those who aren't. So in other words, the name of the role that's been defined seems to have some sort of hierarchy. And people who end up with role of, say, chairman, tend to feel that they're better than some of the others. And I know that is seen also in some of the other profiling methods that we've both come across in the past. So I much prefer the way Profit works in here, and that you've got 16 core roles. If you've got 16 roles, it's very hard to say that this role is better than that role, and I'm this and you're that, so I'm better than you. And we do see too much of that in teams with other types of system. Secondly, you don't tend to have only one role that you're good at. Now, I guess it's possible. Have you seen that?
Very rarely. But it's very, very rare. And you're talking at sort of deep level specific detail that people are operating at. The vast majority of people play into more than one space, play into more than one role.
Exactly. So a person doesn't define themselves. I'm a this, I'm a that. I'm a this and a that and a that and a that. And these are the ones I prefer to do. These are the ones that I resonate better with, if that's the right way of putting it, or that resonate better for me. And these ones are the ones that don't at all. So it's a much more even-handed way of looking at things. And my gut feel is that it's much more approachable from the point of view of the team who is working and finding out about themselves by going through the process.
I think so. I think also you're pulling at a thread here that we maybe need to bring to the surface. I suspect we've all been guilty at laughing at the job title inflation that happens from time to time. But underneath that, language is important, and language links to emotion. So it does tell us there is something about the language of a team that goes to the team's motivation and mindset. And maybe when we're putting together teams, we need to think about how we collectively come together and the language that we use to describe that, so that we are discouraging the I'm this or I'm that and encouraging the dialogue that says these are the things that need to be done, and actually Fred needs to play in this space and that space, Ginger needs to be leading here and here, and for us all to feel rather more comfortable, and I guess underneath that feeling rather more valued through the language helping us to see how we actually contribute, how we belong.
The word value really sticks out there, doesn't it? I'm sure we've all sat at meetings where one person isn't saying anything, and that's partly because somebody else is saying things that are fairly negative about them or about the role they're trying to do. So they're not valued, so they're not going to contribute. Or at least they're not going to do so willingly, which then undermines the whole purpose of the team.
And I think that might just open up actually an interesting conversation on its own. And I want to come back to this idea of hard and soft teams, of hard teams in particular, having hard boundaries. And there is that natural tension between we, the team, and they, everybody else external to the team, which can still be within an organisation, but of course can go beyond that to more external stakeholders. No team exists in isolation. It's expansion of the no man is an island idea, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's that point of being a jigsaw. You know, we fit into a broader picture. And that fitting into is important. So how we fit into the rest of the organization as a team, or how we fit into the supply chain involving suppliers, sponsors, governance, beneficiaries, all becomes an important part of making sure the team is able to function both in and of itself, but also to deliver whatever its intended output or outcome is for that broader organization, for that broader stakeholder set. Now, in soft space, we can call everybody a member of the team, and that's great. But actually, if we're talking about hard deliverables, we may want to engage your suppliers as a member of the team. But if they're not operating to a contract with us that enables them to do that fully, we're starting to create a delivery tension in what the team's trying to do. So there is something there about, as a team, understanding the kind of boundaries that we have with a range of stakeholders and making sure that we manage them in an appropriate way. And sometimes that might be a contractual way.
Certainly if they work for an external company, then yes, there is an obvious need for some sort of contractual relationship that covers the work that's been done. Because otherwise, A, why would they do it? And B, if they do it, why would they report it in the way that we want them to, or take actions from us, and so on and so forth.
So you can see with suppliers, we might end up having to put in place extra contractual terms in order to make things work for everybody involved. We're probably not going to do that with sponsors or beneficiaries. But we still, as a team, need to think about how that relationship is going to work. So we take, for example, beneficiaries. If we apply our soft team thinking, the instinct is we're going to go out there, we're going to engage our beneficiaries, we're going to tell them what we're doing, we're going to tell them they're part of the team, and we want their support and help. if we do not sustain that relationship, if we do not demonstrate that we are listening to them and adjusting to their needs, they very quickly get the message they're not actually part of the team. And it's not a long walk from there to being, we're not even of interest to the team. Why are they of interest to us? So it's not just a theoretical idea about how do we manage the boundary. It's recognizing that how we manage the boundary has implications for our chances of successful delivery.
Well, that's something in there in particular that grabs my interest. And that is where you're saying that the beneficiaries don't feel they're being listened to. And if not being listened to, what's the point? That is reflected very often, very commonly in real life today, is it not?
Yes.
We see it in the papers or online every day. Now, so if beneficiaries may be defined as part of the soft team by some of the people in the hard team, then there must be various things that form that boundary in terms of things like accountability, responsibility, authority. And my take on that is that those are the province of the hard team, all those ones. They are the ones who will be held accountable. They're the ones who are responsible for getting it done. They have the authority, must have the authority, to get done what needs to be got done. Now, that in itself is something that can be questioned, because how often is it the case that the team has been told, yes, you can go to XYZ and they will do whatever it is you need to be done. You have that authority. And in practice, that turns out not to be the case. And the team is then being undermined.
Thank you. I've been smiling all the way through your saying that, but that lovely idea that a team should have the appropriate level of responsibility, authority, clarity, to have proper delegation given to it. In 30 years, I think I maybe worked in two teams where that was true.
That's two teams more than me.
And, you know, I worked in some good teams, but only two, I think, where the whole lot came together in the way it should. And there is definitely one of my fun coaching conversations is when we talk about the difference between delegation and abdication.
Yeah.
And this is something that often happens to individuals where a task is delegated to them. In other words, we can't be bothered, you do it. And this is really more tag you're it than actually thinking in a business planned way. Turns out you can do that with teams too.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so you can create a team. There's, oh yes, Team X is now responsible for these things. As though that absolves everybody else in the jigsaw from their part in the story, from their part in the big picture. It also can mean, without the boundaries, without the authority and responsibility clearly defined, that team space can become something of a dumping ground for a whole bunch of other difficult questions.
Yeah, there's a couple of phrases that go through my head, which I'm not going to actually use on the recording. But yes, we've seen this happen again and again, I'm sure.
So I think there is definitely a need as a team to be clear about, and I suspect more often than not, to have documented what delegation looks like for that team. What is the limit of responsibility and of authority? What authority do they have over other organizations? And this brings us back a little way, for example, to why we might need to change some contract terms with suppliers, because we might need to ask for something slightly different from them. But also in terms of responsibility, what are we supposed to be passing upwards in terms of information to assure any governance mechanism?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And making sure that the information is right, both in terms of comprehensible to the people who do governance, but also properly reflecting what the team is there to do. Because sometimes the standard KPIs aren't right, particularly if a team is engaged to do something innovative.
Yeah, something that's outside the box, to use the common parlance.
Yeah.
It does raise a question, though, in itself. And you mentioned the word documentation, and as you know, it's not one of my favourite subject areas, but we all have to do it. Are you suggesting, then, that we should have... Let me take a step back for a sec. A team has been put together. It's got the right mix of personalities. It's got the right mix of capabilities. It's got the right size. It knows what it's doing. Should that team then document, however briefly, all the other points that you've been talking about? In other words, boundaries. In other words, explaining stuff to governance in terms of the level of authority, the level of responsibility, that type of stuff. And if so, Should there be a template for this?
So I think there are, I've multiple levels of answer to that question. So the first one, cards on the table, both you and I have been dragged through the world of programs and projects. So you know we're going to say yes just based on that experience alone.
I was trying to avoid it.
But it's true. So we all saw for a front of it, admitted. But actually, at the practical level, if we're talking about creating a team, it's clearly implied in that statement that the team is there is something new. Therefore, people don't know who it is, what it's about. And for some people, that therefore represents a level of threat or uncertainty. So the team is going to be drawn into explaining who it is, what it's there for, what its responsibilities are anyway. Having that documented makes it easier for all members of the team, both now and over time, to tell the same story so that their view is consistent. But it also helps in that negotiation as a new team with those connection points around the jigsaw that says, you know, we are new, but look, the board has decreed that we must be doing this. And they've asked you to help us in this way. How do we now set that up? That doesn't guarantee that there won't be resistance, because there's always resistance to change. It's the nature of the beast. But at least it starts to put that thing in context.
Okay, so that's all fine and dandy. I suspect there are differences also in this depending on the size of the organisation. If we're talking about, let's say, a 30-person company and there's a project team, then pretty much everyone's going to know about it and know what they're doing. If it's a company of 30,000, then the vast majority will have absolutely no idea whatsoever. So does that mean there's a potential for variation in the level of documentation, the type of documentation that one might need? I'm not trying to get out of doing documentation. Let me just add that bit, first of all.
So it used to be said that if you put four economists in the room, you could guarantee they would come up with five answers. And I think underlying that is a recognition that humans have a habit of filling in the story. So I think the issue is about speed to recovery. So I think one of the practical differences between a 30-person company and a 3,000 company is the speed to recovery when there's been misunderstanding, when things go wrong, and about the way in which you can communicate. But actually, I think there's no real difference between small company and large company in the ability for humans to make up the story based on what they've heard, which isn't necessarily what they've understood, and therefore come to the wrong conclusion. Now, if you translate this, you know, we've been through that process of setting up as solopreneurs and going into business. All the stuff you are advised to do when you're setting up your company and when you're running your company day to day, year on year, the principles are exactly the same, whether you're one person on your own or 50,000 people operating in 20 different countries.
Yeah, that's very true.
The volume of documentation may look a bit different,
yeah.
Granted, but those basic principles I think are worth doing. So I would encourage, even in a small company, I would encourage documentation, but let's not create a small library. Let's do what is necessary to help everybody understand where things fit.
Okay, I'm happy with that answer. That makes it sensible. So we've talked about literally who's on the team, what makes the team effective, focal points, collaboration, team types. We've had a bit about stakeholders. We've also mentioned a little bit about delegation, I think, haven't we not?
So I think it's been an interesting exploration. And as always, it's fascinating actually to start to talk these things through, to start to challenge our own assumptions. I think possibly the key takeaway from today for a number of us is that question of who is your team. It begins with that obvious human sense of connection. So it begins by looking at Fred, Ginger, Bob, Alice, people I know, people I can work with. If we're talking about putting together effective teams, actually, we very quickly do start to expand into, we need to be thinking about role, we need to be thinking about capability, we need to be thinking about personality, we need to be thinking about capacity. We need to be thinking about how we bundle those together effectively in a clearly defined team environment so that that team can come together and then engage in what it does, but also engage with external stakeholders in an effective and clear way.
Is there anything else you think we should cover on this call now?
I think for this first exploration, that's probably enough for people to go away and have a headache about, isn't it?
Well, that's my gut feel too. The more you talk, the more there is to dive into, and the more you dive into it, the wider the holes in the net become for you to fall through. So there's an awful lot of stuff around this area. Okay, well, everybody, thank you for listening to this. I hope you found it useful, and look out for the next one in the near future. Bye now.